to it, I get that.
Well, we'll see.
Well, right, we'll play it back.
All right, okay.
This is Edris Wise on December 20th, 1984, speaking to Joseph Boyce for National Council of Jewish Women Oral History Project 2. Dr. Boyce, would you like to state your name and address for us while we're testing the microphone?
My name is Joseph Boyce. I live at 825 Moorwood Avenue, Pittsburgh, zip code 15213.
Perfect.
So I can raise my voice a little, whichever you want.
This is Edris Wise speaking to Joseph Poise on December 20th, 1984 for Oral History Project 2, National Council of Jewish Women. Mr. Poise, I would like to start today asking you about your jobs and what they consisted of and the contributions that you feel you have made.
Well,
starting with the J.L. Jacobs and Company, Chicago. And what I will do is use the write-up from Who's Who in America, since I would assume that this was probably researched fairly thoroughly and most of the jobs are chronologically listed.
Thank you. Well, my position with J.L. Jacobs and Company began in 1929, even before I had received my PhD from the University of Chicago. J.L. Jacobs and Company called themselves management engineers, I guess, and management engineers and consultants. At that time, their clientele consisted really exclusively of governmental agencies such as the Cook County government, the city of Chicago, the city of Philadelphia, etc. And of course, I was employed because of the fact that I had done graduate work in political science. The work gave me a very realistic picture of what government was all about when I was studying political science on a graduate basis. That of course gave me a very theoretical insight into government. But when I was associated with J.L. Jacobs and Company, there I became attuned to the realities of government because I saw what were some of the problems, what were some of the difficulties. I even obtained insight into corruption in government. And then I had a better perspective of the problems which we face in getting government that is of suitable quality. I worked for J.L. Jacobs and Company from 1929 to 1935 and progressed very rapidly. My compensation was raised in a very generous manner. Some of the experience I obtained was most interesting, particularly a survey we made of the state government of Illinois at the time that Governor Horner, that's H-O-R-N-E-R, who I guess was the first Jewish governor of Illinois. In fact, I don't recall that we've had that. That Illinois had a Jewish governor since then.
What was his first name?
Henry Horner. He had been a judge in the probate court judge in Cook County, which is the county that includes the city of Chicago, and was elected governor and then re-elected governor. Because I handled the Department of Public Welfare in a survey, which was the largest department in the state and included all the state institutions, whether they be mental institutions, so welfare institutions proper, or whether they be the penal institutions, that those all came within my purview, and that experience was truly a fascinating experience. In fact, I found the the work so challenging that I was even offered a key position in the Department of Public Welfare after the study was completed, but I decided that didn't fit into my career. Well, as the depression became worse, that was the period of the depression, the business of J.L. Jacobs and Company dropped off, and I just felt that the company wasn't going to be very stable for a while. And so I accepted an offer, which was made to me by Donald C. Stone, to whom I will refer subsequently. He then was advising the Works Projects Administration. They called that the WPA during the Depression. Let me explain. That was the project which President Roosevelt initiated get men back to work, men and women back to work, and which put, I guess, the number of people were put back to work. There were all sorts of activities that went on, and Mr. Stone asked me whether I wouldn't want to become a consultant to WPA, and I seized the opportunity, because as I said, I was uncertain as to where the Jacobs organization was going. And so I went to Washington, D.C., and found that a very, very demanding assignment, particularly since I was placed in charge of developing the financial procedures for implementing the WPA. Of course, here we were talking in huge terms, and I did find the assignment difficult, fascinating, and certainly a very challenging one.
Who did you work under at that time?
I worked under Mr. Stone, who had been brought in from an organization called Public Administration Service, and this Donald C. Stone was the head of the Public Administration Service, to which I'll make reference subsequently, and his responsibility was to develop the organization and procedures for the WPA. In other words, we were the organizational and procedural unit within the WPA.
Did you have any direct contact with President Roosevelt at the time?
No, at that time, no. Contact was with the heads of the chief executives of WPA. Of course, Mr. Hopkins, Harry Hopkins, was the director of WPA. I think I might have met him once, but my day-to-day contacts were with the key, you might say, the key subordinates to Mr. Hopkins. And that experience was again invaluable from my standpoint, and I, as I said, found it very satisfying type of work, particularly because of the vital nature of WPA, which played such a key role in terms of helping people who were out unemployed. As you perhaps know, there were proposals to have such a project on in connection with the unemployment which we've experienced in the last few years in the United States. But be that as it may, Mr. Stone apparently was very much impressed with my work, and he finally said, why don't you join this public administration service? I should explain that what public administration service was again a consulting organization to governmental units, in that respect similar in subject matter to the Jacobs and Company, but was endowed by the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Fund. In other words, it was a not-for-profit organization again created to help governmental units improve their organization, improve their procedures, and Mr. Stone offered me a position with that organization, which I accepted because, as I have already indicated, I didn't feel that the Jacobs organization at that particular period had a very bright future. My work with public administration service, about 3 years, perhaps 3.5 years, in the course of which I had some very responsible assignments. I was made what they called a general field supervisor, and therefore was given responsibility for supervising various of the projects, including such things as reorganizing the very important aspects of the Kentucky state government, the Michigan state government, and activities of that type, which obviously were very interesting. And in fact, I claim authorship, as my Who's Who biography indicates, for two studies, one which wrote up the financial administration of the state of Kentucky, and one which was based upon the state of Michigan. In the course of those studies, I made some very important contacts, and I also feel that some of the work which we did were important contributions to the advancement of state and local government in the United States.
Can you be a little more specific about that and give us examples?
Well, for example, the state of Kentucky, when we undertook it, by the way, they call that the Commonwealth. You know, some of our states are called like Pennsylvania Commonwealth, the Commonwealth of Kentucky, was just about bankrupt, and they couldn't pay their bills, and they issued what were basically IOUs, and they had some other consulting organization had proposed a reorganization, but nothing had been done about it. We went into it. We set up a Department of Finance. We set up very, very tight financial controls, and helped that state government to get on its feet. Then Kentucky was able to, on the basis of the budgeting and other controls we established, Kentucky then was able to pay its bills, and Kentucky advanced very markedly. This was when a famous governor occupied that post, Governor A.B. Chandler. They called him Happy Chandler. He was a very, very interesting character, and I understand even to this day he inquires about me. He still lives, in fact.
Positively or negatively?
Positively, no. In fact, I just received a call from one of the former officials of Kentucky, with whom I maintained a friendship subsequently, telling me, as they called him, Happy Chandler. He'd be glad to see me when I come to Kentucky.
Did he inherit this mess in Kentucky,
He inherited this mess, and he had the courage to take very strong action to put Kentucky back on its feet. In fact, because the Public Administration Service, and I should have pointed it out, had its headquarters in Chicago, we were regarded as Northerners. And even though Kentucky is a border state, and this may be beyond your belief, they had more of a Southern tradition and disliked damn Yankees such as ourselves. And so the governor had the fortitude, the perseverance to say, I don't care if they do come from Chicago, if they can help us out, I'm going to retain them, which he did. And he backed us up with the strong action which was necessary to implement recommendations. You know, you can hire consultants, and you hire consultants, and you file reports away. But Governor Chandler moved forward, and he was a very, very strong, personality. And I felt, in a sense, I became a personal friend of the governor, and again, the members of his cabinet. Well, that and we worked up this, call it a manual on financial administration of the state of Kentucky. I have a copy, and that. That was, other states were interested in it. Well, similarly then, I shouldn't say similarly, because the Michigan state government was not in that bad a condition, but I directed placing the Michigan state government, again, on a sounder financial organization basis, and again, that received a great deal of attention, not only in Michigan, but in other jurisdictions. I forget which one of those two studies received some sort of an award because of its outstanding character. I might say also in Michigan, I directed a study which ultimately led to the establishment of civil service in the state of Michigan. Again, the state retained us, and I directed the study of the personnel setup, and Michigan ultimately went civil service system. I might explain, because the name of Litchfield will come up subsequently. Litchfield, who was the of course the chancellor of the University of Pittsburgh. That I met Litchfield at that time, because Litchfield was a graduate student at the University of Michigan, and the chairman of the commission responsible for hiring us to make this personnel study, as distinguished from the financial study, the personnel study of the state of Michigan was Litchfield's mentor, James Pollock. He was Litchfield's mentor at the University of Michigan, and of course Ann Arbor is very close to Lansing, Michigan. So I did get to know Litchfield while I was directing the personnel study, and he would come over and talk with me, and we'd walk together and discuss the government of the state of Michigan. So that the work for this public administration service was, shall I say, satisfying. It was demanding. Of course, it involved a great deal of travel. As you know, any sort of consulting position of that type means you cannot lead a normal family life. And I became a little restless about the constant travel, one time being in Hartford, Connecticut, another time Lansing, Michigan, other time Frankfort, Kentucky, another time in Cincinnati, Ohio, and that became rather wearing, although the work itself was very, very interesting. So I took a civil service examination in the federal government, what they call an unassembled examination, where all you do is submit your credentials. And I found myself then on the civil service list. And as a result of taking that examination, I was offered a position, which at that time they called it, Bureau of Old Age Insurance. Now I think it's called Old Age and Survivors in Insurance. And I was offered the head of a section in the Bureau of Old Age Insurance. The section was called Administrative Analysis, this section. Public Administration Service did not want to release me, and they insisted that I take a leave of absence while I was trying out this federal position. And so I went to, we moved then to Washington, D.C., our youngest child had died. two before, yes. And so we moved to Washington, D.C., and I assumed this responsibility in the Bureau of Old Age Insurance, and I had a staff working under me studying the organization and procedures of this vast program, this program you hear, basically of Social Security. And I can, the study which I found really was my key project while I was there was a study in which they keep the records on old age insurance, Social Security. You know, I don't want to bother you with the detail, but you know, they keep records of the wages that people earn, and that means keeping records on millions of people, and those records are the basis for paying Social Security. At that time, they were using the punch card, the IBM punch cards, and they had a huge establishment in Baltimore, Maryland, which worked actually three shifts. They worked right through the whole day because of the difficulty of maintaining those records. And my unit was asked to make a survey of that unit, particularly the procedures. And that was a highly intensive study. In addition to the people who were directly under my control, they assigned other individuals to work with me. So I had quite a staff under my supervision studying that setup to say, is this the way in which they should do it? Should they decentralize it? They worked on the basis that they were going to have these records split throughout the United States in regions. And then they said, well, is that going to work? Decentralize these records, because American people move from place to place. They don't just stay in one region. We have a highly mobile population. And my study was supposed to make recommendations on that. Well, we really, really worked on that most intensively. And finally produced the report. In the meantime, this Donald C. Stone, to whom I had been, to whom I made reference previously, this Donald C. Stone, and who was at that time director of Public Administration Service, on which technically I was on, from which I was on leave, he was appointed the head of a division in the United States Bureau of the Budget, in the Executive Office of the President. They were then reorganizing the United States Bureau of the Budget. He was made a division chief. And he approached me about coming over to the United States Bureau of the Budget. At the same time, when the head of the Bureau of Old Age Insurance heard about that, then he said, well, he would offer me a position which I think would have been essentially one of the assistant directors of the Bureau of Old Age Insurance. And so I had a question of a choice between getting having a very responsible position in the Bureau of Old Age Insurance, which of course is a vast organization, and they're going over to the Bureau of the Budget. Well, as if you even read the newspapers about Mr. Stockman and whatnot, you know that the Bureau of the Budget is a key agency of the President. In fact, they had then, under President Roosevelt, had moved it up, had expanded its importance. And in fact, the man who had been director of the budget in Michigan, when I was directing that study of the financial administration in Michigan, was the new director of the budget. So here, the new director of the budget knew me, Stone knew me, and so obviously there was no problem there being appointed to the Bureau of the Budget if I wanted it. Not that I applied, as Mr. Stone had made the overtures. And I decided, appraising the two, that the Bureau of the Budget would be the more interesting assignment, would fit into my career better. So although I just served 1 year in the Bureau of Old Age and Survivors, of course now they call it Bureau of Old Age, I guess, and Survivors Insurance, I left. But
right, before we go on with the next step, I'd like to get your opinion and some information from you on Social Security and what is happening today.
Okay.
As opposed to what went on then.
All right.
There is a lot of talk now that, that our children will not have any Social Security because there will be nothing left in the till. Why is this happening? Do you think it is a good thing or a bad thing, and what caused it?
Well, I think, like any program in the federal government, politics, and of course not that politics is a bad word, but politics in the sense of political expediency enters into it. I feel that that in many cases they change the law, the benefits, not on not according to what might be considered sound considerations, but because of political expediency, or call it pragmatism, on the part of the on the part of the Congress, and so that weakened the system, whereas they in figuring out the benefits, they did not follow the technical considerations, or observe the technical considerations which should have been observed. And by the way, in the division which I was located in, the Bureau of Old Age Insurance, we had a very fine actuarial section which was in a very good position to tell them, you know, just the soundness of what was being done. But I think these unfortunate, you can't call it extraneous considerations, because politics is implicit in government. So I think what happened is they weakened the system, and in the sense of expanding benefits without thinking of what this would cost. You also have the factor of the greater longevity of the American people. An actuary, after all, anticipates a certain life expectancy. We've had a longer life expectancy, which means then that you have to be prepared to pay benefits over longer periods of time than you originally anticipated. Of course, they have now modified the Social Security law, at least so far as the regular Social Security benefits, as distinguished from Medicare. See, Medicare
right.
is a separate program. So that for the moment, at least, in fact, I was your question is sort of coincidental, because I was just reading an article in the Wall Street Journal as to whether Social Security is so sound, I think right now they feel with the additional tax, of course you pay a tax, the additional tax they imposed, that for the present it is secure. But we'll have to watch it. We'll have to watch it very, very, very carefully. I think at the present, it looks good, provided that Congress does not go ahead and start expanding benefits or following the procedures that are unwise. I think they were frightened enough by the impending, should we say, insolvency of the Social Security Fund, so that they did take necessary measures to put Social Security on a sound basis.
Wait a minute.